everybody. Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2015. This is Getting Geeky, and I am Miranda Janelle. Tonight's topics are, well, hey, it's Wine Wednesday. Sure, my usual cohort bailed on me tonight, but that doesn't stop me. Tonight's lovely selection is a Ménage à Trois Silk. It is a blend of light-bodied red wines, and it is quite tasty. The first time that I tasted it, in fact, I was maybe 3 feet behind where I currently am right now, and I took one sip, put down the glass, and started jumping up and down, and I squeed. I full-on squeed. This is a tasty, tasty beverage. I highly recommend it. Once again, Ménage à Trois Silk. It's a lovely, lovely light-bodied red wine blend. And that's the exact power I need to talk about some fall television, because so far this week, it's been great. Hey, what are you laughing at, cat? I look over at the chat, and the cat in the chat is definitely there. And, oh, kitty, kitty, kitty. I thought you were going to say you set down the glass and chugged the bottle. Well, I think I may have finished the bottle that night. And, the night is still young. It's not quite 10 p.m. yet. So, anywho, I wanted to talk about the fall television lineup because it's been good this week. I've really enjoyed it. So far, I have watched Once Upon a Time, Gotham, Supergirl, and The Flash. And Once Upon a Time came with a really nice surprise. We got 2 episodes this weekend. Season 5, episode 8, titled Birth. And, was it ever? It was definitely a birth story. Where we left off in the storyline, we got to see the origin of the original Dark One. And the original Dark One's connection to Merlin. Hey, it was his girlfriend. She drank from the Holy Grail and became an immortal magical being, but she used it to seek vengeance on the invader that had driven her from her home and killed everyone else in her village. And that turned her, you know, using the magic for vengeance turned her into the Dark One. And this time, there will be spoilers.
Arg! Fair warning! There be spoilers ahead, mateys!
In this episode, we got to see Hook spending most of the episode demanding that Emma reveal what actually happened to them in Camelot. And oh, is it a doozy! We get to see a little bit more of Emma returning to form. You know, the entire season so far, it's been like, all right, what's up with the Dark Swan? Like, I get why they're doing this, but no one likes an evil Emma. It's a fun character to play around with, and it certainly fits within the show because in Once Upon a Time, they take beloved characters and they add a twist to them. You know, Arthur Pendragon, he is not the king that you would expect him to be in Once Upon a Time. In fact, even in one point of this episode, he draws Excalibur and cuts Killian Jones across the throat. Now, don't worry, Emma heals him, but at what cost? And also, I'm not sure what I just said the best example of Arthur not being who you would expect him to be, because Killian Jones is Captain Hook, and Captain Hook is typically a villain, but at this point in the story, he's transformed into a hero, and Arthur is very much so a villain. I really enjoyed the Lancelot storyline and how Guinevere returned to Arthur's side. Again, spoilers. It was magically induced. He lured her over. She was truly in love with Lancelot. Ooh. Oh, that was a fun story. Excalibur is not whole. The Dark One's dagger is actually the tip of Excalibur, and Merlin bound it to Nimue, the Dark One, or specifically the spirit of the Dark One. The human host is not immortal, but the essence of the Dark One is. So in effect, now that Emma is the Dark One, she is in practice immortal, but in practice, I don't know. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to move on. She is immortal, but it's the Dark One that's immortal. Emma is not. But no matter. The quest is to reunite the two pieces of Excalibur and reforge the sword and extinguish either light or dark magic. They're kind of playing with it. We don't know where they're going to go, but that's okay. It's perfectly okay. The goal, at least in this episode, is to reforge Excalibur and extinguish the darkness from Emma so that she can go back to being the savior. And she very nearly does reforge it in Camelot. Now, things get a little timey-wimey because at the end of the last episode, Emma had already reforged it, but that was in present day. Now we're back, I believe it's 6 months prior, back in Camelot, and we see that she very nearly reforged it, but it wasn't after, or it came after Arthur and Zelina, aka the Wicked Witch of the West. They had a failed attempt to use Merlin to lure Emma into giving them the, oh my gosh, I'm completely forgetting what the name of the spark is, but it's the spark or an ember from Prometheus' flame, and that combined with the two fragments of Excalibur and a little bit of magic can reforge Excalibur. And Arthur's goal is to gain control of the full Excalibur and lead his land to be the king that Merlin prophesied. But hey, we found out he's a villain, and it's all good. Well, no, it's not all good. But he's using Merlin against Emma and her family. In fact, he even has Merlin attempt to kill Snow White, Emma's mother. Oh no, this is terrible. But he's Merlin, and Emma, before Emma has fully embraced the dark side, yes, also a Disney property, before Emma has fully embraced the darkness, she convinces Merlin that if anyone can fight it, he can, and Merlin overcomes Excalibur's hold, or the sword fragment of Excalibur's hold over him, and does not kill Mary Margaret, and Zelina and Arthur escape. But this is also when Arthur cuts Killian Jones, aka Captain Hook. And hey, having Dropbox sync while you're doing a live show, not going to work out too well. But that's all right. That's taken care of. And we're moving on. Emma ultimately ends up healing him. And then as she's reforging Excalibur, because his wounds came from the Enchanted Blade, his wounds reopen up and he bleeds out, and Emma's completely and totally grief-stricken, and everyone else be damned. She knows the risks of bringing him back, but she can't bear to lose her love, and so she uses her magic to bring Hook back, and oh, what a consequence it has. Again, spoilers if you don't want to hear the resolution of the of Once Upon a Time season 5 episode 8. Tune out now. All right, I think that's been enough time. Hook is now a dark one. We've got two dark ones. This makes me wonder. In the process of Hook being restored, having his life restored, we actually see Merlin kind of become like an energy or magical being, or no, he's already a magical being, but he kind of transforms into an energy state and then flows across the vast distance to wherever this field is that Emma is restoring the life to her precious love, and all of his magic actually ends up, or his essence flows into Killian, bringing him back to life, and at that moment is when it's revealed that that Killian has become a dark one, and it really makes me wonder if because Emma was willing to give up her darkness in order to restore the sword, if there's some kind of duality at play going on in the storyline where there has to always be a balance between the dark and the light. I'm wondering if they're going to go there with that. That's what I took away from this episode. I thought it was great. I love that we're dealing with two dark ones at the same time right now. Who will regain control of Excalibur? I don't know. I'm going to tune in. I'm sure they're actually going on their winter break, so I'm sure they're not going to be back until like the end of January. But I anxiously await the next episodes of Once Upon a Time to find out. But like I said, we actually got two episodes on Sunday, and the second one focused primarily on Merida and her ascent. Her ascent to queen of the clans Dunbrock, McIntosh, and I'm blanking on the other two clan names. Oh, all right, it's not going to come to me in time, so I'm going to move on. One of them started with a D, but I keep wanting to say Dingus, and I know that one of the clan. I'm from the clan Dingus. No, I know that's not it. So, like I said, I am going to move on. But in this second episode, we got to see more of Merida's backstory and her interactions with her father, King Fergus, and they had a nice nice few bits of some nice exchanges where they both learned from each other. But Merida is going into her first battle with her father, and in order to learn to fight, her father King Fergus has hired a mentor for her, and being Merida and headstrong, she takes on this tutor and like, I don't need a man to teach me to fight. And And ultimately, it ends up being Mulan. Yay, we get to see more of Mulan in Once Upon a Time. This is awesome. Merida and Mulan become friends, and Mulan teaches her how to fight properly. She's a wizard with the bow and arrow, but and now she really learns how to fight. And during the course of the battle, King Fergus is slain by a knight. And I completely jumped ahead. Prior to the battle, King Fergus went to the witch, the very same witch that actually turned Merida's mother into a bear in the first place. King Fergus went to the witch and asked for magical help ensuring his kingdom's future because southern raiders... southern invaders were on their way, and he wanted to ensure the future of the kingdom. And the witch gave him a magic helm that would give him control over anyone that he leads into battle. And so, of course, he's wearing the helm the day of this, you know, what would be his final battle, where the knight strikes him down, and Merida very nearly... saves his life, but her arrow is just off the mark. And this mysterious knight cuts her father down by stabbing him in the back and takes the helm. And now we flash forward to Merida's coronation as queen of the clans. And the witch returns and demands payment for the helm. Or the helm. And... If she doesn't get the helm back with, you know, by the end of the next day, then everyone in Merida's kingdom will be turned to bears because, you know, hey, it's brave. They like bears. I don't know. I dig it. It's I love the bear theme going with that. It's pretty cool. But now I'm thinking of a silly thing that Jim drew, and I am actually actively distracting myself. So I will carry on. Merida spends most of the episode struggling with figuring out how to be a better leader, and she ultimately discovers that her father was using an enchanted helm, and that he led everyone, to their death in that final battle. You know, wearing this helm, and so she had to figure out how to do what her father could never do, and that was lead. And ultimately, it ends up boiling down to his teaching. You know, she does ultimately figure it out, but at this point in the story, her confidence is completely and totally shaken. She's run into Mulan again, and now Mulan is basically a petty thief. She's no longer fighting with honor. And she's become completely unhinged. And it's suggested that she became unhinged because she waited too long to tell Aurora how she really felt about her. And now that dastardly Philip has scooped her away. And so Mulan can never have her true love. And that's what unhinged her. Yeah. I gotta say, I kind of like Mulan unhinged. You know, she's got a lot of crazy in her eyes. It was pretty cool watching, you know, watching those fighting sequences. And I gotta hand it to the actress Jamie Chung, who plays Mulan. She really impressed me in that episode. So much of the performance was just the look in her eyes. That's what really, really sold it. I thought it was amazing. It was great. And the return, I don't even have this in my notes, but we got to see, Ruby, Little Red Riding Hood. Ruby returned in this episode as well. It was a great team up episode. And ultimately, it all ended up having a very happy ending, and I loved this one. The episode itself more or less stands on its own from the rest of the series and tells a good story of a queen learning how to lead her people and earning their respect at the same time. Very, very good story condensed down into 1 hour. I thoroughly enjoyed The Bear King. All right, let's move on to Gotham, Season 2, Episode 9, A Bitter Pill to Swallow. Now, we had an appearance in this episode, a guest appearance by Michelle Gomez. You might know her as Missy from Doctor Who. And she plays a fun one in Gotham. Where we left off with Gotham last week was Jim Gordon has just arrested Mayor Gallivan, and Barbara Keene sustained considerable injuries when she let go, hanging from the attic of the church. She let go of Jim's arm and plummeted to the ground. She sustained heavy injuries, and Mayor Gallivan's sister blames Jim Gordon for the imprisonment of her brother and the despair that she feels over Barbara's current state. And she goes to a mysterious lady that runs a club, that runs a club of hitmen, I suppose. It's kind of a really more of a casino, but apparently they're all hitmen in there. And the mysterious lady is played by Michelle Gomez, and she sends multiple assassins after Gordon. The first one strikes as Gordon is going up to Gallivan's penthouse in the elevator, tries to strangle him with piano wire, you know, total pro job and everything, according to Gordon and the captain, Captain Barnes. Gordon ends up besting the hitman, of course, because he's Jim Gordon. He's a badass. A badass with a dark side. That's another one that they've been playing up lately, especially in last week's episode, carrying on into this one. And it does play heavily in this episode. But Gordon dispatches the first hitman, and so the mysterious lady sends a group of hitmen after them. If I remember correctly, it was three of them, and they all show up inside Gallivan's penthouse, and they go after Gordon and Captain Barnes and Officer Parks. Her first day on the job, and she's nervous, but you know, Gordon's giving her pointers on how to get through this challenge that she's facing. He basically says, you know, hit them in the center mass and don't stop shooting until you're sure. And she survives the onslaught. And ultimately, they're injured, but all three of them make it through and escape the second round of hitmen. And at this point, the mysterious lady reaches out and calls Eduardo Flamingo. It turns out he's a hitman, but he's also a cannibal, and he's got a flair for the dramatic. He has a really awesome fight with Gordon when he finally shows up. In fact, when Gordon finally starts to best him, it's almost like the guy is getting turned on watching Gordon's dark side start to come out. it made for a really, really interesting scene. And Gordon was struggling with crossing the line. And prior in the episode, Captain Barnes was and Gordon were talking about the line. And we got a little bit more of Barnes' backstory And it really informs why he has the policies that he does at the GCPD. But that last fight between Gordon and Eduardo Flamingo, that was quite a spectacular fight. Just, I highly recommend this episode. If for nothing else, that fight, it's just fun. And it's sadistic, kind of, you know. I mean, the guy's really getting turned on by getting his ass kicked. And then he gets all disappointed when Gordon doesn't kill him. It's... another really fun aspect to this episode was at the end of the last episode, Edward Nygma was tracking the person who had visited Miss Kringle's burial site. He was tracking down the other person that knew, and it turned out it was the Penguin, and Penguin's injured after his ordeal with Galavan and Butch, and Nygma spends part of the episode nursing Penguin back to health, and he starts telling him this story about how he's done, you know, he started doing something lately that's been changing him, and it's for the better, and he's been killing people, and you start really seeing his psychotic side come out, and having Nygma and Penguin paired up in this episode was I just thought that was really interesting. Both of these actors, Corey Michael Smith playing Edward Nygma and Robin Lord Taylor playing Penguin, I think they're my favorite parts of the show right now. They're both crushing it. They're just absolutely crushing it. The portrayal of Nygma's descent into madness is... I'm loving watching this character develop, and Penguin is showing a lot of resilience. He keeps getting pushed to that breaking point, and he keeps coming back. I'm eagerly waiting to see where they go with these two characters. They really are my favorite right now, and having them working together, it proved to be a very, very fun episode. All right, let's move on to Supergirl, Season 1, Episode 4, Live Wire. This is their Thanksgiving episode, or as they were calling it at one point, Friendsgiving. We had a couple of guest appearances in this. Britt Morgan came in as Leslie Willis, a.k.a. Livewire. And then Helen Slater appeared as Eliza Danvers. Actually, really, Dean Cain was in this as well. A little bit. But Helen Slater was played a much larger role. She came to visit her girls for Thanksgiving. And at first, all is well. She's, you know, she's proud of Kara for everything that she's doing, but Alex just doesn't trust it. You know, she's waiting for the inevitable storm, and does it ever come? You know, an epic argument between mother and daughter ends up occurring, and it takes up a majority of the episode, or it's stretched out across the episode, I should say. And ultimately, we end up learning more about the family's history with the DEO and Hank Henshaw himself. And that leads to an interesting question, but I'll get to that at the end of talking about this. The main story in this. The villain of the week was Livewire. She started out as radio personality Leslie Willis, and she goes after Supergirl on air. And in retribution, Cat Grant demotes her to the traffic chopper because, you know, Cat Grant is the one who branded Supergirl. She's, you know, she doesn't want the negative, you know, the negative press for Supergirl being associated with her name, and ends up demoting Leslie Willis and forces her into the traffic helicopter, which is called the Catcopter. How cute is that? How vain. but I still think it's fun. You know, if I could have a Siebes copter, I totally would. So I can't fault her for naming her traffic helicopter the Catcopter. It's cute. A storm breaks out. Supergirl saves the day. First, she saves the pilot, and then she goes back for Leslie Willis. And while she's making contact with Miss Willis, lightning strikes Supergirl, and it flows into Leslie Willis, now enhanced by a Kryptonian, and it ultimately ends up transforming Leslie Willis into Livewire, and she ends up leaving the hospital and jumping into the electric grid, where she ends up going after Cat Grant. And in the first attack against Cat Grant, another interesting question in my mind was brought up, and again, I'll get to that in just a few moments. Let's see. Kind of lost my spot in my notes. Anywho, Livewire goes on and continues to taunt Cat Grant, and Supergirl does end up showing up to save the day, because Kara was already with Cat Grant when she initially struck. And screw it, I'll just go to it right now. There's a moment during the initial fight where Kara and Kat are seeking shelter, and Kara's like, we should really call for help. and Kat just turns to her and says, you know, security's 20 floors down, and like, I'll distract her. And then she reiterates that it's 20 floors down. There's just something about that scene that made me wonder, like, does Cat Grant know? Like, was she just giving Kara the easy out so that she can go transform into Supergirl and save the day? You know, there's been a few different things in this series that have led me to that, but that was kind of the final nail in the coffin. Just the reiteration that, oh, it's 20 floors down. You know, like, you've got plenty of time to disappear and then suddenly show up as Supergirl. It's just, that's how it felt to me. Ultimately, yeah, there are more battles between Livewire and Cat Grant and Supergirl. And ultimately, Supergirl saves the day after an epic battle where Livewire very nearly defeats Supergirl. But then Supergirl gets to make a nice cheesy joke about water and electricity just never seem to mix. It's a fun episode. Not a strong episode if you're a foster parent or if you have foster parents, because the one thing I really didn't like about this episode was with Eliza Danvers and her attitude towards Alex versus her attitude with Kara. And she admits, you know, okay, you know, Kara came to her as a 13-year-old girl from another planet. She had no clue what to, you know, what to do. She was just hoping to, you know, like not add to her grief, basically. But Alex is her daughter, you know, it created a separation between foster child and actual child. I don't feel like they properly, you know, like it was the best message to be, you know, sending, especially to someone who's a foster kid and being told, you know, like, oh yeah, we love you as if you were our own. Well, maybe not so much, because you're clearly favoring your own. It didn't sit right with me. But I did mention that I was going to bring up another question that this episode has had me thinking about. It went a little further into the family history with the DEO and Hank Henshaw, and there was a moment where young Kara and young Alex snuck out after night, and Kara took Alex out for a fly, and then the DEO shows up, and it's led by Hank Henshaw, and they're demanding, you know, like, hand over Kara, basically. Hand over the Kryptonian. You know, we can't, you know, we haven't been able to get Superman, so, you know, you've got another Kryptonian here, you know, give her to us, because we're the DEO, and, you know, what is it, the Department of Extra Normal, crap, what's the O? See, if it was the DEA, you know, maybe like the Extra Normal Affairs, I don't know. I just forgot the name of the agency. It doesn't matter. They're a secret agency. We're not supposed to know about them anyway, right? Right? That's how this works. Anyhow, Hank Henshaw and the DEO show up, and Jeremiah Danvers, they refuse to hand over Kara, but he says, all right, well, I'll give you the next best thing. You know, I'll come to work with you, and I know everything there is to know about Superman. So this leads me, you know, when I first saw Hank Henshaw's eyes light up and become red, I immediately thought, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, is he John Jones? You know, like, is this just John Jones in disguise, the Martian Manhunter? And I got really, really excited. And then I found out, like, oh, no, Hank Henshaw is actually an established character in the DC universe. And you know, spoilers, he becomes the cyborg Superman, and, you know, and ultimately becomes a villain. But he's got the powers of Superman. And so, all right, Danvers is going to work for you. He knows everything there is to know about Superman. How long are you going to string us along along with this until we find out that it's Jeremiah Danvers' research, you know, Supergirl's foster father's research on her cousin that ends up leading to this supervillain who recruited her foster sister. You know, they're working their web. They're working their web. You know, just how long are they going to just flat out make this explicit? Yeah, this is where I feel like they're going with the show. And I would love to see the storyline play out. I'm just wondering how long it's going to take. what are you talking about, Kitty? With the Mutant Registration Act? I don't know. All right. So far, I am still thoroughly enjoying Supergirl. And I'm not even going to touch the little love triangle that they're working up, because that's where these shows can kind of, you know, that's where they start to lose me, if the love stories aren't done right. Now, I enjoyed the Clark Kent and Lana Lang love story in in Smallville, but it was one of those like, okay, yeah, let's just get, can we get to Lois already? Like, we know that Clark doesn't end up with Lana. So, you know, unless Lana just changes her name and somehow becomes Lois Lane. But no, that's not how, no, we know from Superman 3 and Smallville that Lana Lang does not grow up to be Lois Lane. She grows up to be Martha Kent. Duh. Hey, knock it off, Kitty. How dare you? I'm not even going to repeat that. That is not going in the recording. Anywho, the whole love triangle that they're working up between Kara and James and Wynn and Lucy Lane of all people to bring into this. I reserve judgment until it plays out, because who knows, I may get completely and totally wrapped up into it, but sometimes that's where these shows lose me, you know, and I get it. I'm a little bit further outside their core audience and they're not writing this stuff, with me in mind. They're targeting a younger demographic. And so you keep having, awesome cheesy one-liners, you know, like water and electricity not mixing, and show me some good fights and some further character development. I will be right with you. I'm enjoying the hell out of Supergirl. Now, what I'm really enjoying the hell out of is The Flash. Season 2, Episode 8, Guerrilla Warfare. Grodd returns. Now, in the previous episode, Barry had just gone up against Zoom, and Zoom broke his back, defeated him very, very publicly, and then dragged him around Central City and put him on display for all to see. You know, see your hero, you know, as he falls. And Barry is coping with no longer being that symbol of hope for Central City. They've seen their hero fall. They'll, you know, he feels like they'll never look at him the same way. And, you know, he attempts to open up to Joe with this, but it doesn't do the trick. So Iris calls in the big guns and gets Barry's father in there. And there's some nice moments between them in this episode. And it's really cool with John Wesley Shipp playing, you know, Barry's father. It's, you know, like, what a perfect person to be giving him advice on how to best be the Flash. I'm gonna squee every single time I think about that casting choice, because it's just brilliant. I love it. In fact, I want to go back and watch the 1990 Flash all over again, because I remember watching that live when it first aired, and just what a brilliant casting decision. Absolutely love it. There was with Barry's father being there, there was a nice little moment with Joe and Iris talking, where you can kind of see a little bit where Joe is dealing with a little bit of jealousy or wondering what it was like, you know, to have an actual son of his own, because again, he was Barry's foster father, you know, but that relationship just isn't the same. And they make that, you know, they make that clear. They did it in Supergirl and they did it in Flash all in the same night, you know, like DC properties across two different networks. You know, like, seriously, what are you guys trying to make commentary on the foster, you know, like on foster parents and foster kids? You know, I don't know what to deal with that, but it was a good setup. In this, because, you know, he was wondering, you know, all due respect to Iris, but he was wondering what it would have been like to have an actual flesh and blood son of his own. And I'd remind you that there have been rumors about Wally West coming to The Flash in the near future. And with the recent return of Iris's mother a couple episodes back, with those rumors and now this little like, oh, I wonder what it would have been like to have an actual son of my own, you know. Stop teasing us. Just bring Wally into this already. All right. So in this episode, Barry is, and I got to put air quotes around this one, slowly recovering from having his back broken. You know, he recovered much faster than anyone else could humanly, not even humanly, you know, because he's super, he's got that superhuman healing, and it takes the entire episode, but ultimately he does end up getting his speed back. Maybe, I don't know if it's 100%, but he's having to deal with not being able to walk at first, and then, you know, learning to walk again, and then running and not being able to tap into the Speed Force, and just the loss of his speed. He also had to ditch his girlfriend. You know, he's got this budding romance with Patty, a character who I love. I am loving Patty Spivot. You know, she's quirky, she's goofy, she is absolutely gorgeous, and she has a hell of a lot. The actress that plays her, oh gosh, what's her name? It's Chantel, I think. I'm blanking. Oh no, why does this have to happen? Because there's a microphone in front of me. That must be it. And of course, I don't even have The Flash open on IMDb. So it's just making it that much harder to actually even look this up. But she's... oh, come on. Really? Now I can't even pull it up based, you know, going on like the latest episode. Yeah, they've had that there for everything else I've been to tonight, except for The Flash. We're crying out loud here. I'm just trying to look up a name and keep going. And Chantel Van Satten. There we go. And she plays Patty Spivot. I love her portrayal. And she and Grant Gustin have just absolutely great chemistry. I'm loving the pairing up of those two. But she's getting suspicious, you know, especially after the controversy of what Barry's favorite kind of chicken soup are, because, you know, he's sick and contagious and can't be around anyone, because, you know, it's not like everyone under the fracking sun knows that he's the Flash. So, you know, what's one more character to add to this? I mean, the one girl that he went out with, Linda Park, just found out last week that that Barry was the Flash, you know, because he needed her to trust him. She's like, oh, I made out with the Flash, and you're really, you know, you're working side by side with Barry's true love, you know. Just saying. It's where all, you know, again, the love triangles, it's just like, just get to it. Barry and Iris are gonna end up together. Stop, just arg. I don't know. It's another romance that is written towards a younger age group. So I will bite my tongue, and just enjoy the story for what it is, because ultimately the whole romance angle, it doesn't. You know, I was just gushing about the pairing of Barry Allen and Patty Spivot, so I'm just gonna focus on that, because that's where they're really crushing it on the romance angle. But in this episode, Grodd does return, and he kidnaps Caitlin, and Caitlin was always kind to him. That's something that they bring up multiple times in the episode. And ultimately, what like Grodd wants is more of his kind. He wants Caitlin's help to create more super intelligent telepathic giant gorillas. And there's some interesting battles going on, but because Barry is still healing, he's not out in the field. Everyone else is. So they've kind of they've turned the tables, and now Barry is playing support while everyone else is going after Grodd and trying to recover Caitlin. It's a good episode for Dr. Wells. He impersonates Eobard Thawne as Harrison Wells, and I found that interesting. I really enjoyed how they have had him slip up at one point when dealing with Grodd, and Grodd called him out on it, but he ultimately ended up proving to be the genius that he is and regained control of the situation. It's just a really awesome, fun episode. And at the end of it, Grodd is sent to Earth 2, and you see him looking out over Gorilla City. And oh, did that look cool? It was out in a jungle. It's got this, you know, awesome tropical forest landscape, and then there's stone and wooden architecture and, you know, mixed into the landscape, and then there's multiple monuments of gorillas, and Grodd just lets out this awesome roar. It's a really cool, fun episode. Yeah, it's been a good week for TV. And oh my gosh, I didn't even bring up Sisko and his awkward date, where I don't think that they actually, if they said that he was going to see the Princess Bride, I must have missed it. But he was basically talking, you know, like action, you know, romance, you know, sword fighting, you know, just giving the whole spiel that the grandfather gives to the kid when talking about the Princess Bride. And I just had a nice little squee moment at that. And then while holding Kendra's hand, you know, he starts to vibe and he sees this angelic wingspan and someone floating up in a light, but you know, face and chest are kind of obscured a little bit. Now, I know looking at this, because you know I have access to the internet, I know that they're teasing Hawk Girl, and they made it clear that that's who she's going to be with that one. But there's a scene later on where Sisko is, you know, very goofily apologizing to her for running out on the date, and and then they kiss, and he gets another vision of Hawk Girl, and because he's vibing, like there's a moment where it's just clear that he's not present, and Kendra brings it up again. And, oh, just the best cover. He just kind of steps back and is like, oh, no, I'm sorry. It's just that you're a really good kisser. So I need to rethink my position on how they're dealing with the romances in these, because they really crushed it in this episode. They really, really crushed it. And it's actually been fairly strong this season in The Flash. I am absolutely, absolutely loving this show. is it next Tuesday yet? No, it's not. But You know what it is, though? It's about 12 minutes away from when The Arrow becomes available on Hulu for me. So, I'm gonna wrap this up, get this episode posted, and then go watch another show. How's that sound? Alrighty, I am Miranda Janelle, and if you have found this anywhere other than the website, go over to take37.com, check out Not Just Getting Geeky. We got links to Midnight Movie Nights, as well as the comic that Fracking Cat and I are working on, WTF Dave. And in the future, there'll be even more there. So yeah, take37.com. That's where you can find this. Alrighty, I am Miranda Janelle, and I'll be back soon. Thanks for joining. Oh, hey. How did my... You look over to hit the button and all of a sudden things are all locked and you can't hit the button. Let's see. Should I go with... should I go with my normal outro or should I go with... what about my old theme? That might be an interesting one to go out on. Nah, I'll go with the regular outro. But... first, no, stop it. Can't do anything right. All right, I'm Miranda Janelle, and like I said, I will be back soon. Thanks for joining me. Stop.